Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. Hi, this is Shane Vanderhart. Welcome back to another episode. Happy Friday. Hope you had a great Valentine's Day this week as well. I just wanted to talk about a couple items in the news, namely President Trump's national emergency proclamation to get started on building the border wall, as well as Andrew McCabe's interview with 60 Minutes this week that's obviously getting a lot of attention. So also later on, I had a conversation with Jeremy Taylor, who's a candidate running in Iowa's 4th Congressional District. He's running in the Republican primary. That's right now a four-way primary. I know Congressman King, at least as of right now, we know he's going to run again. At least it's assumed he's going to run again. Randy Feenstra, whom we've interviewed on Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast, and somebody else, and I can't think of his name off the top of my head, so I apologize. But then Jeremy Taylor just recently announced as well. But before we get to all that, first, a word from our sponsor, American Principles Project.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, Project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
Well, President Trump today announced that he is going to declare a national emergency in order to secure the border. This is should not be a surprise. He's been telegraphing that he could possibly do this if a deal wasn't made. This is something that's been widely discussed, and today he finally pulled the trigger. Just reading from basically the White House website, they have some talking points regarding President Trump's border security victory. Basically, it says, securing our border, President Donald Trump is following through on his promise to secure the border with legislation and executive action. President Trump was elected partly on his promise to secure the border with a barrier, and since his first day in office, it says he has been following through on that promise. As the president said, sections of the border wall are already being built, and legislation and executive actions are building on that progress. So the executive action being taken by the president makes additional funding to secure the border that they say is essential to our national security. The legislative wins they cite is that President Trump secured a number of significant legislative victories in the Homeland Security Appropriations Bill that furthers his effort to secure the southern border, protect our country. For instance, the bill provides $1.375 billion for approximately 55 miles of border barrier in highly dangerous and drug smuggling areas in the Rio Grande Valley, where it's desperately needed. They also note that more than 40% of all border apprehensions occurred in the Rio Grande Valley sector in the fiscal year 2018, and the Rio Grande Valley was the border sector with the most known deaths of illegal border crossers in fiscal year 2018. $415 million will go towards addressing the humanitarian crisis at the border by providing medical care, transportation, processing centers, and consumables. And this is President Trump successfully rejected efforts by some to undercut Immigration and Customs Enforcement's ability to uphold our laws and detain illegal aliens, including criminals. ICE funding supports nearly 5,000 additional beds to detain illegal aliens and keep criminals off our streets. Customs and Border Protection will receive funding for 600 additional officers. The bill will help keep deadly drugs out of our communities by increasing drug detection at ports of entry, including opioid direction, staffing, labs, and equipment. Something to note, too, that I know Daniel Horowitz at Conservative Review noted, that unfortunately there's language in the bill that gives local officials the right to veto in the Rio Grande Valley, the right to veto having walls built in their, in their, I guess, jurisdiction. So how much of this 55-mile section of wall that will actually, or border barrier, will actually be built is really unknown. He goes on, they talk about the executive action. He says President Trump is using his legal authority to take executive action to secure additional resources, just as he promised. Actually, he was considering it. He didn't necessarily promise to do that. Certainly, that wasn't part of the... I don't recall that being part of his campaign pledge, but maybe it was, and I'm just forgetting. So it says, in part, he's declaring a national emergency that makes available additional troops and funding for military construction. Including funding in Homeland Security appropriations, the administration so far has identified up to $8.1 billion that will be available to build the border wall once a national emergency is declared, and additional funds have been reprogrammed, including about $601 million from the Treasury Forfeiture Fund. Sorry, couldn't get that word spit out. Up to $2.5 billion under the Department of Defense funds transferred support for counter-drug activities. Up to $3.6 billion reallocated from the Department of Defense military construction projects under the President's declaration of a national emergency. These funding sources will be used sequentially and as needed. The Department of Homeland Security, Department of Defense, and the Army Corps of Engineers, the White House says, are working to create a prioritized list of segments and a work plan for the remainder of fiscal year 2019 and beyond. New projects could include new levee wall, new and replacement primary pedestrian barriers, new vehicle-to-pedestrian barrier, and new secondary barrier. So they make a case that this is that he's got the authority to do this. He says the president is using, the White House says the president is using his clear authority to declare a national emergency as allowed under the National Emergencies Act. Since 1976, presidents, they say, have declared nearly 60 national emergencies. Most of the previously declared national emergencies have been continually renewed and are still in effect after being continually renewed. Multiple governors have declared states of emergencies along the border in the past. For instance, former Arizona Governor Janet Napolitano, who became President Obama's DHS secretary, declared a state of emergency along the border in 2005. Former New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson also declared a state of emergency at the border in 2005. I don't remember what was going on in 2005 exactly. This is former President George W. Bush and former President Obama both directed the use of the military to assist DHS in securing and managing the southern border. And former President Bush declared a national emergency in 2001, which invoked reprogramming authority granted by Title 10 United States Code Section 2808. Both he and former President Obama used that authority a total of 18 times to fund projects between 2001 and 2014. So, I don't have a problem with the wall. I don't have a problem with the sections of the wall being built. I definitely think border security needs to be beefed up. I'm not criticizing any of that at all. On the face of it, as far as the money that's being allocated and what their projects are going to be, it looks pretty sound, I think. They certainly make a pretty compelling case as far as his legal authority to do this. I have to say he's probably on better legal footing than President Obama was when he used his pen and a phone to implement DACA. But that being said, what constitutes a national emergency is probably going to be up for debate, and I'm sure it's going to be settled in court. I guess my problem with this being used for this particular project is, for one thing, he has touted that, for instance, illegal border crossings are down. He touted that back in February. We're at a 45-year low. So that kind of speaks against this actually being a national emergency. Two, what governors have done, that's neither here nor there. That's irrelevant as far as I'm concerned. That's really dependent upon state law and their state constitutions. As far as President George W. Bush declaring a national emergency in 2001, what happened in 2001? Oh, yeah. September 11th happened. The Twin Towers fell. The Pentagon was attacked. Are we really equating what's happening at the border that's been going on for years with that? It's not the same thing. Now, if he has to declare a national emergency to mobilize National Guard troops down to the border, that's fine. He has the presidential authority to do that. He is the commander in chief. I guess my problem is him doing this just after on the coattails of not being able to negotiate funding for building the border wall or border barrier or whatever it's going to end up being. That's in the spirit of President Obama's pen and a phone. Well, I can't get it done through Congress, so I'm just going to do it myself. And I think that's executive overreach. Frankly, I think we probably need to revisit the National Emergencies Act anyway. Maybe, I don't know, I've read through it. It's very vague. And vague laws like that make me very uncomfortable. And I think vague laws have the potential of being abused. You know, we've seen that also with the War Powers Act. I just want to make it clear, this has nothing to do with, you know, I don't disagree. You know, I don't necessarily think we need a border, you know, a wall along the entire length of the border. But I don't disagree with the goal of border security. Not at all. And this has nothing to do with you know, my view of President Trump either. If this was President George W. Bush ordering this in this fashion at this time in these circumstances, I think I'd have a problem with it as well. Or if it was, you know, President Cruz, if President Trump lost and Ted Cruz won, you know, it doesn't really matter who occupies the White House. I've been very concerned over the past number of years of the growing executive, the imperial presidency, and the growing reach of the executive branch, and that I feel like checks and balances and separation of powers being stepped all over, and doesn't matter whether it's my guy or the Democrats' guy or you know, Trump or whoever's in the White House, the separation of powers and the proper checks and balances need to be respected. Congress, you know, they need to do their job. And I guess the frustrating thing to me is that Republicans, they controlled the House and the Senate. They could have gotten this done. Why didn't they get this done? We should not even been at the circumstance. So I think a lot of the blame lays with Congress, certainly. You know, preferably I would have preferred seeing President Trump, instead of declaring a national emergency, you know, veto this spending bill, because I think the spending bill is awful. And then enforce another government shutdown. I don't think it's the end of the world when the government shuts down. I would rather see the government shut down for reasons other than a border wall. But if you're gonna stick to your guns like this, if you already went through one government shutdown because of you know, the border, do it again. Stick to your guns, because Democrats, I'm not sure, especially with the poison pills interlaced in the funding bill, I'm not sure they're negotiating in good faith. So, my two cents. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the courts. And again, I want to say that I will admit that he probably has a better legal footing for doing this than President Obama did for a couple of his executive actions. But ultimately, we'll have to see what the court decides and how they view his actions in light of the National Emergencies Act and how they view the National Emergencies Act in light of the Constitution. And that was my daughter who called, and I should have silenced my phone. I had to take a quick break and talk to Kelvy real quick. The danger of working at home and being late on a Friday afternoon, as well as, just having my cell phone on. I should have turned that off before starting recording. But anyway, good phone call with Kelvy if you care. I also want to talk about an interview that former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe had with 60 Minutes. He admitted to ordering the obstruction of justice investigation in the President Donald Trump the day after, or at least getting the ball rolling on those investigations, the day after President Trump fired James Comey and made Andrew McCabe acting FBI director.
I was speaking to the man who had just run for the presidency and won the election for the presidency, and who might have done so with the aid of the government of Russia, our most formidable adversary on the world stage. And that was something that troubled me greatly.
How long was it after that that you decided to start the obstruction of justice and counterintelligence investigations involving the president?
I think the next day I met with the team investigating the Russia cases, and I asked the team to go back and conduct an assessment to determine where are we with these efforts and what steps do we need to take going forward. I was very concerned that I was able to put the Russia case on absolutely solid ground in an indelible fashion, that were I removed quickly or reassigned or fired, that the case could not be closed or vanish in the night without a trace. I wanted to make sure that our case was on solid ground, and if somebody came in behind me and closed it and tried to walk away from it, they would not be able to do that without creating a record of why they'd made that decision.
You wanted a documentary record.
That's right.
That those investigations had begun because you feared that they would be made to go away.
That's exactly right.
Well, that was an interesting segment of the interview. I think the most compelling part of the interview was an admission that he briefly discussed invoking the 25th Amendment with Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. Here's the transcript of that. I've been unable to isolate the actual audio clip from it, but here's what Andrew McCabe said to Scott Paley of CBS News. Discussion of the 25th Amendment was simply Rod raised the issue and discussed it with me in the context of thinking about how many other cabinet officials might support such an effort, unquote. Scott Paley responds, quote, Rosenstein was actually openly talking about whether there was a majority of the cabinet who would vote to remove the president, unquote. McCabe, quote, that's correct, counting votes or possible votes, unquote. Paley, what seemed to be coursing through the mind of the deputy attorney general was getting rid of the president of the United States. McCabe, quote, well, Paley, one way or the other, McCabe says, quote, I can't confirm that, but what I can say is the Deputy Attorney General was definitely very concerned about the president, about his capacity, and about his intent at that point in time. Paley asked, how did he bring up the idea of the 25th Amendment to you? McCabe, quote, honestly, I don't remember. It was just another kind of topic that he jumped to in the midst of a wide-ranging conversation. Anyway, that's incredible. He's kind of walked that back a little bit, but you know, those were his direct. That's what he said during the interview, and that's remarkable in that to discuss the 25th Amendment in that way. And if you're not familiar with the 25th Amendment, I want to read that applicable section, if I can get to it, give you a little civics lesson today. This is section 4 of the 25th Amendment. Section 3 is when the president temporarily relinquishes power to the vice president when he's unable to discharge his powers and duties This is like when he's going on, you know, under anesthesia, or if he, or if you know, he's unconscious for some other reason, or if, you know, something like that, where the president is live and temporarily power needs to temporarily go to the vice president. Section 4 is when it's removed, when power goes to the vice president, and it's not voluntary by the president. It says whenever the vice president and a majority of either the principal officers of the executive departments or of such other bodies as Congress may by law provide transmit to the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives their written declaration that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the vice president shall immediately assume the powers and duties of the office as acting president. Thereafter, when the president transmits to the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives his written declaration that no inability exists, he shall resume the powers and duties of his office unless the vice president and majority of either the principal officers of the executive department or of such other body as Congress may by law provide transmit within 4 days to the president pro tempore of the Senate and Speaker of the House of Representatives their written declaration that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office. Thereupon, Congress shall decide the issue, assembling within 48 hours of that purpose, if not in session. If the Congress, within 21 days after the receipt of the latter written declaration, or if Congress is not in session within 21 days after Congress is required to assemble, determines by two-thirds vote of both houses that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the vice president shall continue to discharge the same as acting president. Otherwise, the president shall resume the powers and duties of his office. So, I mean, ultimately, it's up to Congress. But this is, you know, what if this is what Rosenstein, and Andrew McCabe were talking about. I mean, this is an inappropriate use, in my opinion, of the 25th Amendment, Section 4 of the 25th Amendment. This is supposed to be in, if you've got a president who is mentally ill, you know, has perhaps maybe a brain tumor, something that, you know, he just doesn't have the mental capacity. And I know you got some armchair psychologists who like to say that President Trump is insane. That, I'm sorry, doesn't cut the mustard. Disagreeing with his direction, with his policies, that is not an adequate reason to invoke the 25th Amendment. I think the 25th Amendment invoked in that way, that's really no better than a coup d'etat. And hopefully Congress would smack that down. I don't know if the Senate definitely, I don't think, would approve it. I think the House of Representatives probably would under these circumstances, unfortunately, since they're under Democrat control. I don't know if they would have two-thirds, though. So it's just remarkable that was a discussion that was actually had. This is not the appropriate use for the 25th Amendment. You know, if you don't like your president's policies, the appropriate means to remove him is make sure he doesn't win re-election. You know, you need to vote him out of office. That's what they need to do if they don't like how things are going. That's the constitutional process, not an abuse of the 25th Amendment. So that was, I found that disturbing, that admission disturbing. And frankly, I think Mr. McCabe, that's, you know, he has a lot of hubris to think that that's okay and that somehow it's the FBI's job to safeguard us from a president they disagree with. No, that's not their job. And as far as the obstruction of justice, instigating obstruction of justice investigation after his lawful dismissal of the FBI director, that's troubling as well. President Trump, as the chief executive, has the authority, the constitutional authority, to fire the FBI director for any reason that he wants. And obviously, Mr. McCabe's fears have not come to pass. The investigation still went forward. The Russia investigation is still going forward. Mueller's going to be releasing his report. So I think a lot of that posturing, that, you know, concern is much to do about nothing. So we'll see what the report ends up saying and what is recommended from, you know, going forward. But this is just, it's troubling that we had a career FBI officials and we had basically unelected bureaucrats acting in this manner. So next is my conversation with Jeremy Taylor. Jeremy Taylor is currently a Woodbury County supervisor. He was also an elected state representative. He's from Sioux City, and he's running for the Republican nomination to challenge Congressman Steve King for the Republican nomination in Iowa's 4th Congressional District. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Jeremy Taylor.
Well, Jeremy, welcome to the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast.
Welcome. So much thanks to you, Shane, and I really appreciate the opportunity to visit.
So a question I ask anybody who runs from office, whether it's a state house or a statewide office or a federal race, why do you want to run?
Sure. Well, I'm running, Shane, because I look at the current state of affairs with issues our country is facing, and I'm really worried about the kind of place we're going to leave to our children. We're facing hard issues. I look at our massive national debt, our 17 long years of war in Afghanistan, and border security issues, and I think that we need to have the kinds of discussions that families are also having around the dinner table, whether that's paying for the rising costs of health insurance or affording college. And I believe if we look at Congress right now, we see a body, unfortunately, abdicating its responsibilities and having very little understanding of its proper role of governance. And so I look at that and have seen an opportunity where we can restore some of that leadership and believe that people are hungry for real leadership and believe that it's time that we restored some of that here in the 4th District. And I also look at the fact that we need a representative who will be in critical positions to most greatly affect change. And unfortunately, I think Congressman King is not able to help move some of the issues that frankly he and I care deeply about, whether that's on a small business, judiciary, or ag on those committees, and believe that that's important to do. And the other reason that I would say is I'm fearful right now that if we don't take back the House of Representatives from the likes of Nancy Pelosi and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and that they will bring us to a direction that is very troubling for our country. And so I think that we certainly must hold this seat if we're going to restore what we have as a republic. And I look at this last election, and I'm worried that if Congressman King is our nominee, we may very well lose that seat for a conservative majority in the House going forward.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about yourself, your qualifications, your background, education, just so our listeners can get to know you a little bit better.
Sure. So I am a what I'd like to call a constitutional conservative, and am somebody who has been called, I believe, to public service, and have answered that call. That started early on in life. My parents were both public school teachers, and I followed in their footsteps, teaching English at the high school and college level for about 10 years. I went to college out in New York and went even further east after that, taught there for a couple of years, and went to Vietnam on a Christian mission and teaching at a university, and met my wife, Kim, there. And we had a decision on where we were going to live and coming back to the United States, and chose Western Iowa and Sioux City because I love our way of life and the way that people here are of the salt of the earth. And so we have 6 children, 4 girls and 2 boys. I'm a county supervisor in Woodbury County and an energy specialist for the Sioux City Schools, saving nearly $4 million in energy costs the last 7 years. And I'm a chaplain in the Iowa Army National Guard. And have served for nearly 10 years in the military.
Where did you get your Master's of Divinity degree?
From Liberty University.
Okay. All right. I looked into becoming a chaplain when I was in the Army National Guard, too, for a while, and didn't end up actually going to graduate school, but that was, yeah, cool. Okay, so how long have you been doing that with the Air National
Guard? I've been a chaplain in the Army National Guard for the last 6 years and have really enjoyed that calling to bring soldiers to God and God to soldiers and to, you know, nurture the living and care and comfort the wounded and honor the dead. And so that's been an integral part of my life and service. In addition to the public service in the Iowa State House from 2010 to 12, as a part of a resurgence of Republicans taking back the House and governing effectively with some real, I think, game-changing legislation, overseeing a $6.2 billion budget and effectively legislating and never compromising on a 100% pro-life voting record or advocating for veterans issues and for taxpayers. And then just currently won my second term to the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors. And again, I believe that I was a change agent there as that board was held by Democrats for about three decades, in which we've lowered property taxes each year for the last 4 years and have set a good trajectory of conservative governance for years to come.
So you've experienced, you know, elected office at the county level, elected office at the state level. You know, what would you say some of the differences between just your experience between, you know, being an elected official at the county level and at the state level? I'm just curious.
Well, at the state level, of course, being in a body, you need to work through committees and with leadership. And at the time that I was in the state house, we were, of course, in a divided government. So the Republicans held the House and the Democrats held the Senate. And so that's a very challenging set of circumstances to get anything done when there's that push and pull, tug of war going on. I was able to effectively move legislation sitting in positions of leadership on committees. I was the vice chair of the Education Committee, but also was able to really set forward some things that hadn't been able to move for years on judiciary. And so I think that's a dynamic of being in state government, whereas on the county level, you know, being five supervisors, it's a little bit easier to take and have a majority really push forward some things that are good for the county.
Okay. So if should you win the nomination, the Republican nomination, I'm assuming you're running in the primary, correct? You're not running it as an independent. I should have asked you first before
right,
we started recording.
Right.
Okay. Okay, good. We got that nailed down. So if you win the Republican nomination and then you win the general election, what is going to be your approach when you go to that swamp, you know, of D.C.?
Right.
Which never seems to – I've never really seen many people improve and become a better person by going out there. How are you going to approach it differently?
Yeah, so I think it's remaining true to my core and to my motivation, which it comes from a place of faith, but also motivated by restoring limited constitutional government and preserving that which we want to pass on to our children. So I believe that I'm someone who's fought in tough situations, both at the county level in what is a place that has been held by Democrats for three decades before we really took and transformed that board, but also at the state house level in representing a house district that had only been represented by a Republican one time over nearly two decades. And so my goal is to win on the issues, be forceful in the debate and the exchange of ideas, ready to stand on the floor and take opponents to the mat by using clarity and arguments, but then also work with people on where we can forge common ground. I think also having a voice back in the district, whether it's in town halls and constituency work, is important so that the families and the people of the 4th District know what it is that we're doing and they know the why. What's the end game and the objective? So some of my priorities are tackling a $22 trillion national debt with a balanced budget amendment, paying as we go like our families do here in the 4th District, and instituting constraints on federal spending. And I think that that's critical because we're facing the crossroads when interest rates hit 8 and 9% that I believe there's no turning back from that fiscal cliff. And so we need to be able to make those tough choices. And I know that it's difficult within that swamp, as you alluded to, Shane, but there has to be someone who's willing to stand and to fight and to see the long goal of this for what we're going to leave our children. And I think that's critical, addressing issues of border security and immigration in such a way that makes sense for the American people. I think will be one of my top priorities. And addressing, again, those issues that are being talked about around the kitchen tables in the 4th District, whether that's the rising cost of health care or less disposable income, and making ends meet, whether saving for college or for retirement. And I think that those are things that we need to get back to as far as some of those kitchen table issues as well.
Okay. So is basically we're, you know, looking at the House right now is kind of a colossal mess with Democrats back in charge. And not that I think the Republican-led House got a whole lot done either, but you know, we're seeing, for instance, Democrats, they're wanting to roll back protections for Americans not having to pay, you know, basically fund abortion, things like that. We're seeing surprisingly an unwillingness to even protect babies who have been survived abortions and they're wanting to also roll back any late-term abortion bans. Not that we have that at the federal level. We've seen different state legislatures in, you know, New York and I think Vermont is trying. And, of course, there was a bill in Virginia that fortunately didn't go anywhere. But what do you think we should be able to accomplish on life? What would you fight to accomplish on the life issue? And basically, I guess, what do you support and what do you think is pragmatic to do?
Right. So I'm someone who's been 100% pro-life throughout my state house experience and believe that we need to stand for life in terms of the most recent legislation that was not successful, something I would definitely support. And I think that, you know, what's happening in Virginia and New York is so disheartening because I'm a believer that life starts at conception and we need to be able to fight for that. I'm also someone that was one of only six Republicans when we were in the majority that would not vote for a Health and Human Services budget because of taxpayer funding for abortion. So I believe that we need to advocate as much as we can and pass legislation that's going to protect human life at every moment from conception on, in as much as it's practical. And so I'm someone that believes in that very strongly and believes that we need to give a voice to Standing for Life.
Okay, so I know President Trump during the State of the Union said he's going to, you know, he wants to see Congress pass the, he didn't necessarily aim it this way, but you know, the title of the bill is the Pain-Capable Abortion Ban, or baby, pain-capable it's the pain-capable, well, it's 20-week late-term abortion ban. So that's something you would support. And what are the things you think Congress should do? I mean, are there particular bills you'd like to see pushed through?
Yeah, you know, the MICA's law, I think is what you're, you know, referring to, the pain-capable unborn child protection.
Thank you.
I believe is something that absolutely would support. You know, and in the Iowa House, I was supportive of going from 24 to 20 weeks. Now that's an incremental approach, but at the same
right.
time, I was the first to stand up on a personhood basis as well. And so both approaches I think we need to advocate for because I think it's critical. And at the time, people had talked in terms of, well, that would only be six lives. And I thought, well, how can it be only? How can we ever use that term only? One life being saved is critical. And yet I believe that ultimately, whether we're picking up yards or whether we're bringing the ball all the way home, that we need to stand and we need to say that life is precious, that it starts at the moment of conception. And in my own personal experience and in my family, Shane, my brother's family, we've had adoptions. And so I just look at that and see the gift that life is. And it just troubles me deeply in my soul to see what's going on in Virginia and in New York and what's happened, especially since Roe v. Wade, if you look at the numbers. And so that's what I would definitely support and support anything that can help us to move on this issue in order to preserve and protect life.
Okay. Yeah, I know Nancy Pelosi has as one of her agenda items to pass, see the Equality Act pass, which would basically, it would rewrite the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to include sexual orientation as well as gender identity. And it would also impact a variety of other federal laws that have protected class as well. One of the things I saw in it, it was basically roll back religious freedom protection in a way where it would basically make the Religious Freedom Restoration Act 1993 kind of pointless. So how, on one hand, you know, we don't want to see LGBTQ folks mistreated or discriminated against. How do you balance that with religious freedom? What would you support? What would you oppose in that realm?
Right. So I think that people need to be able to practice their faith and do so in a way that doesn't discriminate against them, whether it's in a private practice, whether they are making decisions that come from their conscience as well as their own religious freedom as to who they choose to serve. At the same time, you're right, we don't want to discriminate, but a lot of times that definition of discrimination can
right.
be somewhat ambiguous. And so I believe that we ought to make clear that people have protections in place currently, and yet I don't believe that it's the role to be able to discriminate against folks who want to express the religious freedom and that which binds their conscience and their faith.
Should sexual orientation and gender identity be added to the Civil Rights Act?
I don't believe they should be, no.
Okay, I agree. I just wanted to hear it from you.
Sure.
Okay, also, you mentioned too, you know, ending these countless wars we've been in, and we've been in Afghanistan a long time, and of course, I know we're gonna have a drawdown there. Where President Trump says he's going to be pulling out of Syria. Is that something that, what do you think the United States approach to foreign policy and military intervention should be?
I think you should be very cautious. And in fact, I think this is one of the ways that Congress has abdicated its responsibility. You know, we used to talk about Congress having the authority to declare war. And all too often we see the idea that the state of war already exists. And so for me, I look at the current situation and the Afghan government's control is sharply in reverse, controlling only about 55% of the country, and that's down some 70% from 3 years ago. And I think that we need to be careful to know what the objectives are before we enter into any war. And without that, you know, you have the idea of nation building, which if you look at the original intent of the objective, if you're going back to Rumsfeld saying, you know, this is to have a strong central government for a country that in 1,000 years hasn't had one. And so
right.
I think that we have to have strategic objectives that are laid out that are measurable and obtainable. And right now, that does not seem to be the case in Afghanistan. Opium production's up 63% the last 2 years as we spend $1.5 million a day in counter-narcotics efforts. And so we really need to look at what an exit strategy is going to be, while at the same time respecting those who have helped in our efforts. There will inevitably be a regional presence in the Middle East. But at this point, with $1 trillion that has been spent and the cost of 2,200 lives of our service personnel, I disagree a little bit with Randy Feenstra, you know, when he was saying, well, it comes down to the experts and you have to believe in your military leaders and sort of leave it at that. I think that that's an abdication of Congress's role in this. Certainly you respect the Joint Chiefs of Staff and you listen to the conditions on the ground. But at the end of the day, if you simply leave all of those decisions, then it sort of belies the idea that we have a civilian commander-in-chief and that Congress's proper role is to declare war. And two-thirds of those who were there or are there right now and Congress weren't there 17 years ago. So it would be interesting to have a floor vote to look at what an exit strategy does look like. And of course, you're going to have to, you know, look at the fact that one brigade of 2,000 to 5,000 soldiers from a combat zone can take weeks or months. But at this point, unless we have a clear objective, we do need to look at how we're going to maintain a presence in the Middle East, have whether it's a brokered peace in Afghanistan, but we need to have a strategy that's going to wind this down ultimately. And the same thing goes in Syria as well.
Okay. Now, basically Saudi Arabia and Iran are kind of having, they have a proxy war going in Yemen. And we've been involved in that and selling arms, as well as I believe we've had some special operators on the ground. What do you think our involvement should be in the Middle East as far as trying to put a block against Iranian expansion of power? What do you think our involvement should be with Israel and our, you know, our support of them? What do you think that ideally should look like?
I think it should be known that we stand and are a strong ally with Israel. I think as far as Iran goes, that we need to be strategic in the moves that we make, in terms of whether or not we get involved in counterinsurgency and put boots on the ground in any situation. But I think isolating and working strategically with our ally in Israel, as well as with other nations, that we can isolate and not get drawn into essentially another war. We can use airstrikes and power and drones and other means and efforts, but I think that we need to be very careful to kind of avoid that foreign entanglement that I fear has all too often been lost when we have these discussions going forward.
Okay. Shifting gears, back to the United States anyway, President Trump just declared a national emergency on the border in order to be able to divert funds from some military funding to build the wall. Is that the right approach?
I think that building the wall, whether it's simply a long concrete barrier or more appropriately increased border security measures, is a necessary approach. However, I think that doing so under emergency powers is something that we should be very careful of doing. The abdication of Congress's responsibilities and roles is something that I think is one of the real problems. And so let's just rewind this a little bit to the fact that Republicans were in the majority, right?
Mm-hmm.
They had
mm-hmm.
the responsibility and the authority and the power to act and didn't do so. And that's one of the things that really bothers me and where I think that we need to have better leadership and governance is that when a Republicans campaign and they make promises of what they're going to do, they have to follow through. And because that didn't happen, now we're in the situation where we are once again sending fellow National Guard soldiers to the border. And in doing so, we have a president who believes that he must act under emergency powers to do this. I think we need to be very careful. I didn't think that that was a good move under President Obama when he used executive measures with DACA. And I think that we need to be careful about the precedents that it sends mm-hmm. For the future. Because although today we may support the end, the means could very well for a future president be the means of a new Green Deal or emergency powers on something like health care. And so of all the things that have been done under emergency powers, this is a better one in my opinion, but I still think it's a one that is troubling by Congress abdicating its responsibilities.
Okay. You brought up health care earlier and then just recently as far as Democrats might be able to piggyback on declaring a national emergency on health care, try to get their Medicare for All passed. What do you think the appropriate approach to lowering health care costs should be?
Sure. So I think that we need to be able to have free market principles infused in this discussion. And I think as you see government get more involved in the issue of health care, there's going to be added costs. I was just talking, Shane, to a business owner here in Sioux City the other day, and costs over 6 years had gone for his employees from $54,000 to $217,000. And he said it almost put him out of business. And so I think that the more that our government becomes involved in the Unaffordable Care Act, I think the worse off our small businesses and the increase in rising costs is going to be. I'd like to see us be able to shop across state lines. I'd like to see exchanges that have more free market principles involved. And I think that we need to have the federal government get out of the expansion. If we're talking about Medicare for All, there's a simple principle, I think, that we know that there's really no free lunch at the end of the day. And so
right.
as we take on more and more payers, as we look to more subsidies, that simply increases the cost of those who are paying. And the other issue that really bothers me in this is in the Medicare for All debate, it has to do with TRICARE, which is what our military service members and their families rely upon. And that would go away under Medicare for All funding. And so I think that as we look at those issues, that we need to look at what competition really looks like in the system. You know, people can shop for a variety of things online, and it would be nice to have defined healthcare plans that are easily transportable, that you're able to have more competition, and also look at, there's a difference in the tax benefit for an employer versus somebody who has an individually purchased plan. And mm-hmm. so I think that we need to look at the parity there and ultimately move toward more individually purchased plans that have parity and that have competition. That, to me, is the way that we're ultimately going to lower health care costs, as well as tort reform that I think oftentimes adds in an undue burden and increasing costs to the healthcare industry.
Okay. Shifting gears again, you mentioned the debt and balanced budget amendment, and discretionary spending is really just comparatively the entire budget is really small. Reducing the debt's going to probably be near to impossible without addressing entitlement reform. How do you think we should approach? How do you think we should approach Medicaid and Social Security? You know, what can be done with those in order to be able to reduce costs and tackle this debt finally?
Right. So I think that we need to do some of the hard work of entitlement reform and rolling up our sleeves and looking at things like in Medicare, whether that is to incrementally raise the age for Medicare by 2 months per year over 10 years time. There's savings as exponentially as those costs rise. I think we need to look at means testing. I think that there needs to be some hard discussions, because here's the reality. If we don't start making some of these tough decisions, those promises that are made for folks who have all their lives put money into these systems, it's simply not going to be there. It's not sustainable right now. And it's also generational theft by kicking the can down the road and not taking care of these issues to such a degree that every man, woman, and child is paying $60,000 or owes $60,000 to the federal government. So I think that we have to tackle some of these issues and make some of the hard choices. And that's never a comfortable place to be, but the alternative to me isn't justifiable, which is letting the next generation deal with this issue. And then the other thing that bothers me, Shane, is just the amount of interest that we're paying at $364 billion a year. Mm-hmm. I look at our federal government just shut down over approximately 6 days worth of interest, you know, about $6 billion. That fight was less than a week's worth of interest. And I look at what we otherwise could do, and if interest rates keep rising, I think that there's not going to be any turning back. So we have to make some of the entitlement reform part of our spending prioritization, as well as have mechanisms that are going to limit whether it's the penny plan, and Connie Mack talks about and Rand Paul at length, or even if there's government shutdowns and we do a reduction of 1% in spending every 90 days. There has to be some sort of automated means, so to speak, that's going to limit Congress in this way.
Okay. I would just talk a little bit about education. It seems like there's a push at the federal level, and it's been going on for a number of years, to really push workforce development as a model for education reform. And then we've also seen that, you know, even under President Trump, the growth of the federal Department of Education. What do you think is the appropriate role for government, the federal government in education? Is there a role, and what should that look like?
You know, I'm a believer in the 10th Amendment, and that we need to leave to the states those issues. And I think one of the problems is you've seen, as we've been discussing, Congress abdicate its responsibilities and not act as it should in being the strongest branch of government elected by the people. And yet one of the symptoms likewise of a federal government that isn't doing what it's supposed to do is it gets into areas that it ought not be in. And so for me, education is one of those that really ought to be left to the states. And the more localized those decisions, the better. Whether that's, you know, going down to the state level, and at the state level having parents make choices that are in the best interest of their children, whether that's to go to a public school, to homeschool, to go to a private school. That ability and that freedom, I think, is critical. And so my general bent would be that the federal government should not have as large a role as they do now. And things like No Child Left Behind, I think there's a reason that that was something not only George W. Bush, but also Ted Kennedy were both champions of. And I think that it ultimately has not had the intended outcome that was promised.
Yeah, right now, obviously, that was reauthorized in the form of Every Student Succeeds Act, and now states submit a state plan for the Secretary of Education to approve or disapprove. And that just just the idea that the Secretary of Education at the federal level can okay, you know, it's like constantly asking Mother, may I? If you had the opportunity, if you're elected, to repeal Every Student Succeed Act, would you do that?
I would, and I do so because I do not think that it's had the intended outcomes that are promised. And so each of those measuring sticks, are different in each of the states, right, with varying standards. And so I do not believe that, especially given the amount of money that's spent under, formerly calling No Child Left Behind, I think that that's another area where we have to look to what are the needs of our nation and what is the role of our federal government in comparison to the amount of money that we're spending, and what is the proper role of limited constitutional government.
Okay. And just final issue I want to tackle. We've mentioned it a couple times, the Green New Deal with Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who introduced that along with Senator Markey in the Senate. Have you had a chance to read through that? What are your thoughts? And this whole push towards, what are your thoughts on climate change in general?
Right. Well, I am someone who has, for the last few years, been what I'd call a conservationist in the fact that I help conserve energy.
Okay.
And I do so from the fact that taxpayers spend money for energy in our schools. And so have saved about $4 million doing so over these last 7 years. And if that helps to reduce pollution, I think that's a good thing. Of course, there's the Puritan in me never wants to waste anything, right?
Right.
With that being said, I'm suspect on the idea of human beings contributing significantly to climate change in such a way that has to hamper American industry and business. Now, certainly, we don't want to have smog-filled cities, and we want to have clean air, clean water. Those are things that, without a doubt, we want to make sure that we are preserving and protecting our environment. And so I see myself more along the lines of a conservationist rather than some sort of environmentalist. But I think that you see right now that the Democrats have shown their hand. And this is a dangerous time that we're living in, because the $7.2 trillion Green New Deal is going to radically change our economy. It's going to change the sort of free market choices and principles upon which we make decisions. Right now, I can choose. I don't have a hybrid car, but I could choose to do so, or an electric vehicle. And when we look at energy initiatives, we do so because it makes sense for taxpayers, right? Mm-hmm. So whether it's LED lighting or frequency drives or whatever is being offered by the industry, it has to make sense from a business perspective in terms of its payback. I grow very cautious about the amount of subsidies that are infused in order to make things supposedly cost effective, because as I said before, there really is no free lunch, right? Somebody is paying
right.
For that either lack of revenue or that subsidy. I do think that there's a way to incentivize that can be helpful from an overall national energy portfolio and perspective, but I think we need to be cautious about how we do so, that they need to be, ultimately it needs to be fair and across industries. And I think that this is the exact opposite of doing any of that. And it takes away people's freedoms, people's choices. And I think that it's really a dangerous creep towards a socialistic outview that, frankly, I'm surprised in my lifetime that I'm hearing people actually advocate, Shane. So
right,
that's something
yeah.
that is really bothersome to me.
Yeah, me too. I want to give you the last word. What are is there anything you would like to talk about that maybe I haven't asked about, or something you'd like to highlight?
Well, I'm excited about this race. I'm excited to talk to central committees and activists and Republican primary voters and people at their doorsteps and at the pizza ranches. We're going to run a campaign that's not going to talk about past controversy or be steeped there, nor talk about someone who we're not. We're going to talk about the issues that are facing Northwest Iowans. And so I'm excited to put forward that vision. And, you know, I'm someone that has some life experiences. My wife legally immigrated here from Vietnam. And so we have a story of some freedoms and opportunities that we've been able to take advantage of as a family and see as we raise our children here in the 4th District and want to leave those our children and our children's children with the kind of opportunities that we grew up with and just see this as a very critical time in our nation's history and want to be able to really advocate on behalf of Northwest Iowans and give them a strong voice in Congress and hope to be that voice.
Great. Well, where can our listeners learn more about your campaign?
Sure. So if they go to www.jeremytaylorforcongress.com, they can find out a little bit more about the issues and learn how to become involved.
All right. Well, hey, Jeremy, thank you so much for your time. Oh, final question. I almost forgot to ask you something I'm starting to ask people that are guests on the show. Because we are the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast, what is your favorite coffee drink?
Oh, I would have to say my coffee of the day is probably just the regular Starbucks black and white.
Okay. Well, at least you didn't say Folgers.
Okay. Sure.
So okay. Well, hey, or that you didn't like coffee. That would have been tragic. But
Right.
I've had a couple of people sheepishly say, I don't like coffee. I'm like, oh, get off.
No, I'm glad I'm not in that camp.
All right. Well, hey, thank you so much for your time. Take care, and best of luck to you.
Okay. Thanks so much, Shane. I appreciate the opportunity.
And that concludes today's episode of the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you happen to be listening to this somewhere other than our website, please be sure to check out caffeinatedthoughts.com. Again, that's caffeinated, CAFFEINATED, thoughts.com, or you just Google Caffeinated Thoughts, and it'll show up at the top of your search screen. Be sure to also to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for email updates. That way you don't miss a single update. You can also listen to our podcast and subscribe to it on Podbean, on Stitcher, on Spotify, on SoundCloud, as well as, who am I missing, Apple Podcasts and Google Play. So if there's a podcasting app that you use and that we're not on, feel free to drop me a line at shane@caffeinatedthoughts.com and let me know, and I'll see if I can get that our podcast on that app as well. So thank you so much for listening. This is Shane Vanderhart. Have a great weekend, everybody. Take care.